Good morning. How's everyone doing? Okay, so far. Small, we have a small little group, but feels like a good beginning. And settling into our practice, making our practice wheel together. Spirit from everyone feels good, real good. So other people might be joining us, if not today, then expect some more people on the weekend. Is that right, Karen? Yeah. This morning I thought we could begin our discussion with kind of a review of our common form of practice. Many of us, when we started to practice, we began with the most elemental or simple form of practice. I remember receiving just the most minimal amount of meditation instruction. And although I didn't understand it in the beginning, I really appreciated that kind of brevity in the beginning, because it helped me find my own way, my own intimacy within the practice, without someone saying step one and step two and step three. And then later on, things became more apparent and they could be talked about. But in the beginning, it was not so. And I think that's kind of a Zen tradition. So we're kind of going in, approaching practice this directly. We're kind of going against the current in a little bit. And there's some that might say that this is a defilement, even, to talk about it. So that's a topic in itself. There was this famous teacher named Kuairong, and Kuairong went to see another famous teacher named Huineng, the sixth patriarch, Huineng. And Kuairong greeted Huineng, and Huineng said, "Where have you come from?" And Kuairong said, "I've come from Mount Sung." And the sixth patriarch said, "What is it that thus comes?" He kind of got right to the point really fast. He said, "So what is all this about? What is practice? What is thusness? What is as it isness? Yatha Bhutam, what are we doing?" And Kuairong said, "Even to say that it is just this, will miss the point." And the sixth patriarch said, "Well, does that mean that there's no practice and there's no verification or confirmation, like we could say understanding could be confirmation, understanding something, or even awakening could be confirmation. Does that mean that there's no effort, there's no actual practice, and that there's no fruition, there's no understanding that comes from that? Is that what that means? The sixth patriarch asked this, and Kwe Rong said, I do not say that there is no practice and there's no verification. I only say that they cannot be defiled. And the sixth patriarch, Weinang, said, good, good. This non-defilement is protected, is confirmed by all the Buddhas and all the ancestors. You are thus, and I am thus so. And so they agreed. So in our investigation of this topic, we know it's a very delicate affair to talk about that which no words can reach. But we can keep in mind that also it can't be defiled. It cannot be defiled. It truly cannot be defiled. We can muck around in it. We can make a mess with it. We can bring all our messy karma to it. We can bring all our comparisons and anxieties to it, but it cannot be defiled. That's the wonderful teaching we got from Weinang. But let's be careful anyway. Just in case. We've all practiced for some time, and we know that this is a very intimate affair, this practice life, and it does have a kind of delicacy or sensitivity to it. So we can approach it carefully, but I think also openly and directly. And we're among friends here, so we can talk. Once again, as I said last night, I'd like to emphasize and reemphasize that this is a kind of teacher's conference. We're developing a kind of confidence and awareness of ourselves as transmitters of the way, of transmitters of light, not just receivers. So every one of us is a teacher. Everyone is a transmitter of light. And there's no one truth. There's many unique truths that make one truth. So for some of you, this might be kind of a review. You might remember this being talked about before. But one final time, I'd like to bring up this sense of how the practice is, how the practice form is conveyed to us. So I'd like to go over some of the practice forms together. Please, if anyone has anything to add, or any questions, or anything to share on the topic, please jump in. So where shall we start? So we start at the front door. So when we come in the front door, we gassho. Our hands come together like this. This is called anjali in Sanskrit. It's called gassho in Japanese. And gassho just means that the palms come together. And the traditional way is, rather than kind of like this, is a little more formally, is that elbows come out a little bit. And I was told that it has to do with the length of these sleeves, which are quite big, to keep them from actually gathering dust on the end, and keep them off the floor. And the bow is from the waist, with a straight back from the waist, about 45 degrees. The tip should kind of be aligned with your nose, or just below your eyes, and your eyes right on that tip. Your bow. That's the form that came from Dogen Zen and Kōden Shinrin-roshi. Kōben said that when you put your two hands together like this, it feels right because they must have been one before. He said such a symmetrical union of these two opposites means that they must have been one before. Sounds strange. I mean, we have these two appendages, but it's like they're two mirror images kind of seeking one another, so they want to come together. He said, in the beginning, there's like one drop of your father and one drop of your mother, and it comes together, and it's just one thing. What is it, a zygote? Mm-hmm. Something like that. Embryo? No, before an embryo. It's a zygote. And then things start to differentiate and two limbs form, or maybe flippers before limbs, or whatever, however it is. But they have this memory of being one before. So there's that feeling in gassho of the hands actually wanting to meet. And he also said that when you bring your two hands together in gassho, you're bringing your left side and your right side together, but you're also bringing your past and your future together in front of you, right in front of you. And you're bringing all that is unwholesome, all your mistakes, all your twisted karma, all your trouble, and all your virtue, and all your beauty, and all your loveliness. You're bringing all that is the so-called good of you and the so-called bad of you together in front of you, and joining them and making them one thing. And from that oneness in front of you, you meet something. You meet In this instance, we're coming in the Zendo, so we're meeting the Zendo. We're saying hello to the Zendo.
Going back a bit, which door, or is it both doors, that we got to show in Bao 45?
Oh, that's complicated. We made that confusing, didn't we, because we have two doors? Yeah. Well, this door with the curtain is treated as the door of the Zendo. So you can, the other door you can walk in and out of without having to gush out. When I gush out, sometimes I remember that, this kind of feeling, but this is such a common mudra for us, such a common gesture that it's difficult to remember it all the time. But whenever you can, whenever this memory comes up, if you can have a sense of all your opposites, the parent in you and the child in you joining, the problem of you and the virtue of you joining, and from that joining, you meet another, you meet something, you meet the room, you meet the Zendo. And then what happens? Then we have to find our seat, right? Somehow we have to find a seat. So, walking in the Zendo is always done in Shashu. And this mudra is Shashu, where the thumb is held very lightly in the fist of the left hand over the sternum, and the right hand covers it. There's a variation of this called a Mount Shashu, which is like this that you're doing right there. This is from Kurosawaki. The left hand represents the human realm, and the right hand represents the Buddha realm. So the Buddha, in this instance, This also represents a Vajra fist. It's a fist of strength, of empowerment. And this is protected by the Buddha realm. So when you move mindfully in the Zendo, from our tradition in Shashu, all movement, whether it's kinhin or just walking to your seat, this mindful walking is done in Shashu. And sometimes we bow in Shashu as well. What's next?
Sitting.
Sitting. We come to a seat. So we come to a seat, and again we gusho. And we greet our seat. So, we say hello to our seat, and then we turn clockwise. And turning all the movement in the Zendo is clockwise. So, again, I'd like to ask all of us to kind of receive this information as if you're going to teach it to someone else. So instead of just receiving it, receive it as if you're receiving teaching information. So please have a sense of this is to be shared, this is to be transmitted, okay? So all turning in the Zendo is clockwise. And I believe that has to do with just the natural movement of the earth. The sun moves clockwise, doesn't it? More or less? Does the sun move this way?
The sun is clockwise. The earth may go the other way.
Yeah, we're actually moving the other way, aren't we? We're the ones that are moving. And we're moving the opposite way. But our parent our apparent perception of how things move. The stars and the planets and the sun is clockwise. So apparently this movement, we're in accord with this natural movement. So we turn clockwise, and then from our cushion we bow to, from Buddha's seat. Now we occupy Buddha's seat. We bow to other beings. We bow to Sangha, or we bow to all beings. And then sit down. And when we sit down to practice, you have to cook. Go cook, Karen. Okay. Thank you for joining us. When we sit down to practice meditation, We also rotate clockwise, and we rotate with our cushion. Traditionally, it's on a there's no mat like this in Zendos in Japan, so the cushion itself just rotates as you turn around. But I think it's slightly different here. So we rotate around clockwise, and we sit down. So everyone knows how to sit, right? Should we finish?
No, I don't know how to sit. Go on.
Me neither. So if we were giving meditation instructions to someone, what would we say? What would we say next?
Following Dogen.
Follow Dogen.
You can put your left foot in the half lotus on the right leg. That's what Dogen says. And I've always wondered about that because it seems asymmetric.
Instead of saying it both ways?
Yeah. So, like that is not according to Dogen.
No, it's like, but it's like this. According to Dogen, yeah. So, will everyone please do this?
Right now.
No.
And this is a correct way for half lotus, where your toes kind of meet the edge of your thighs. That's a good half. That's a good full lotus. Yeah, I don't know why he instructed it. First, the left leg on the or the right leg on the left thigh. I'm not sure. In Fukan Sazengi?
Yeah.
So that's one way to sit. That's just one way to sit. And if we're giving meditation instruction, we have to demonstrate that. Maybe. And then there's half lotus. And a yoga teacher said that, advised me once to be very careful about lifting the foot up in half lotus or full lotus. So rather than yank it up like this, we kind of bring it up with the heel. And that's much better, apparently, for this whole joint, to bring it up with.
The tips from way down here, particularly in the so it's actually pulling up the entire side of the body, and then
from here,
from way down here, and then sort of let it drop when it gets this side gets up higher, and that's sort of a yoga stretch to stretch out this side of the body, and to mean that so that this stress doesn't fall on your knee or on your ankle either.
How do you have this foot, Cliff? How this leg? Do you have it like this under you? after you, like this?
Well, right now I'm sitting in the full lotus
position.
You're
in full lotus.
Yeah, but generally I just put my, I put my right foot in front, and then the left foot is right in front of that. That's the most easiest posture for me.
About as far as I can get is that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Putting the left foot up is the hardest.
Yeah, that's hard.
By the way, if people have real ambitions to sit in the traditional lotus position, there's a number of yoga stretches that are very, very useful for it. And frankly, when I first started to sit, I couldn't sit even Indian style. It's called Sukha. Oh, I'm sorry. It's not called the most comfortable pose. It's like sitting like an Indian, like this. I couldn't even sit like that.
That's how I had to have cushions.
When
I started.
And I made a seiza bench when I first started to sit, because I couldn't sit. I couldn't sit cross-legged at all. And slowly, things got better, and I did some of these yoga exercises, and I was able to sit half lotus and then full lotus. And now I love to sit full lotus because it feels really, really symmetrical, and it feels real. I don't know. You feel sort of tucked in a very secure way. It feels great. It really does, and your spine is well aligned when you sit full lotus as well. Later on, I can share some of those exercises with you if you want. And the other way to sit is some people call it a quarter lotus, where the leg is actually tucked in that crease. There isn't a Sanskrit term for this one, for quarter lotus, but this is a
cheater
common
pose.
This is a common variant, yeah. And then there's the Burmese or perfect posture, it's called, where the two legs are parallel, so they're flat on the ground, and they're parallel, but they're not crossed.
That's how I sit. That's as far as my knees will allow.
This is fine. This is done all throughout Burma and Thailand. There's lots of variations to this, and some people can't do this without their knees kind of floating. And the important thing is to have, like a tripod, to have three points touching your buttocks and the two knees. At least three. Just for stability's sake, you'll have back problems if you don't do that. And the other posture is a seiza posture. Jero's doing seiza right now. Could you show Jero the traditional seiza on your heels, maybe from the side?
Yeah, usually the toes are almost crossed or just crossed.
And that's how you have tea and so on, and how most people sit in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not nowadays. Chairs.
Yeah. And could you show the seiza with a cushion? You'd use a cushion to...
Some people do this way.
Yeah.
The seiza is a little too harsh. And the edge of the cushion keeps you elevated.
So the cushion can be put on the end, and then you sit a little bit forward, not right on top of the cushion, right? A little bit slightly forward.
Works.
Yeah. everybody knows this, right? Everybody can teach us.
Yeah. In my water aerobics classes and many other classes, I guess they say, if it hurts, don't do it. And it seems to me that we should bring that teaching here. What do you think about that?
I wouldn't be able to sit.
I recall a lecture from Ben Coy that Coben gave, in which he talked about the pain that invariably creeps up from I think this is pretty much independent of which particular posture, but there's no, I've never been able to sit through any session in any way without having considerable pain. And in some cases it feels like I'm twisting my knee right now, and it usually does when I'm sitting the full lotus. And I can't sit without, you know, feeling stress. But my measure is that if I get up and walk away, if it's okay in 2 minutes, then it probably really wasn't too bad for me to do that. Mm-hmm. And it may be very helpful. So that's the only measure I have.
Well, what about the use of a chair, like Greg using his chair? There's not that. If you're in pain, you can sit in a chair. If you're in too much pain,
Greg, maybe you could say something about sitting in a chair. How if you were to teach someone how to practice in a chair, what would you say?
Well, first of all, I sit in chair because in the years of my lifetime, I've ruined both legs, so to speak. I mean, I can still walk on them, but I can't do any of the cross-legged postures, so that's why I sit in a chair. Earlier, when I was younger, I sat. I could get into a pretty good half lotus, but I never could get into a lotus. Anyway, sitting in a chair is not without its own challenges. So there is a tendency for me to either lean back, sort of like a deck chair, or also a slump, like
kind
this.
Of collapse. Huh?
So the my experience is the main difficulty in sitting in a chair is staying erect, and that over time can be painful. So it's not. Even sitting in a chair is not without its challenges.
One thing that I've heard about sitting in a chair, I haven't done too much of it, but I heard instructions from other teachers about sitting in a chair, is that it's very good to keep your feet flat on the floor rather than kind of like tucked underneath or anything like that, and have that sense of being grounded with your feet. And also, if you can arrange a support cushion so there's a little slope, you're a little higher in the back. Like we sit on the forward edge of our cushions somewhat, so we're sitting with a little kind of slope. If you can do the same thing with a chair, that will help you align your back and sit up straight. Yeah.
I think pain is a pretty big issue in practice. And I know it was really useful for me for a teacher early on to tell me to sit with ease, because my tendency was to treat the practice as an endurance test. And I think a lot of people come to practice with this idea that practice is about endurance. And I think the way one deals with pain is a very important part of individuals' practice. I think each of us has to figure out how we deal with pain on every level, not just physical pain, but emotional pain and spiritual pain and psychological pain. It's an inevitable part of practice, I think, and it's helpful for a teacher to tell you that it isn't about pain, but that pain is part of it, and that we have to work through. What I discovered was that my reaction to pain was more about the fear of pain than the sensation of pain itself. But each of us has a different relationship to pain.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what we... Some people are very, very sensitive to it, and some people less so. Yeah.
I had something to add to that. When I was sitting once with Angie, she just spoke at a very interesting space in like the third or fourth day during Zazen, which was unusual for her. And she said, trust your bodies. And there was just something in that for me that allowed me to sit without having so much pain. Because for me there was this issue of trust of this stuff holding me up. But that was just my individual experience of it. Because I was in so much pain and I felt that I was just going to, you know, tip over. And she said that there was quite an impact, trust your body. And then I just did that. I just said, okay, I'll trust this thing to carry me through.
I like what both of you had to say, because I never have body pain, but this is my first time, so I can usually sit and be like, oh, da-da-da, but I can feel it in my back, but it's been really not interesting, because kind of like what you were saying, I've been seeing how I go around the pain, and the feelings that surface around it, you know, not feeling like a mountain, a little, and then moving with it, just saying, okay, so if I, it's like a dance. So I'm not saying I want to do it forever and be in pain all the time, but I appreciate that awareness around that, which I've never really personally felt too much in practice. Maybe a little knee pain and that's it. So it's been nice. And then I wanted to ask on the sitting, do you ever suggest for people for getting their knees like the three points? Because I think it's so important. Another cushion, like elevating their back even more. So doing two cushions will help to drop the knees down.
Yeah, you can raise the cushion with support cushions. I like to tell a story of one resident that was here that made a little nest of his practice place. I think he had three cushions, actually.
Abhijit?
No, this was someone else. But Abhijit comes in close second. And he had a cushion under here, and he had a cushion and maybe some support cushions under there. And I think he had a cushion for his mudra as well. He just packed it in. But you know, he made it work. He just, it looked like a little bird or a big bird kind of coming to nest in this little package. So, whatever works. Yeah.
Just with the discussion of pain, because that's been a big thing for me, especially because I used to be a runner. I used to run a lot, and now I have, torn up tissue in my ankle, and I've dislocated this knee, and I've torn up tissue in here. And what you were saying about the endurance thing, I made it worse because I used to sit in full lotus to the point that I would have tears in my eyes, you know, because I thought, this is what you do, you sit through it. Now, because of that, I, you know, it's really difficult for me to sit through sashin because this knee just always gives me trouble. But I think for me, it's pain's inevitable in sitting. But there's a difference between just am I experiencing pain and discomfort, or is my body telling me that it's sustaining damage? Because that's what I have to be careful of. And so I think, like you said, a really good gauge is, like, does it go away, or is there swelling or whatnot? But I think, too, a lot of it is the fear thing. For me, not so much thinking that I'm going to fall over or something, but it's about a future narrative that I always create. And so, you know, oh, I'm in pain. Is this going to inhibit my ability to sit in the future? And then what am I going to do if I can't sit anymore? And so then I pile all of this angst and anxiety on top of it. Mm-hmm. And which makes it way worse than it actually is. So that's a lot of what it is. But I know at the same time, a lot of times, I've had times of sitting during sashin where it's like a union with the pain too, which can be really beautiful. So it's kind of like, I don't know, do I push into the pain or not? And I guess, like you said, it's all about figuring out those lines. And it seems like it's always changing for me, because I'll sit one sashin where I feel really strong, and next time it's like, I just feel like I can't even make it through the first day. So, like this time, my knee's really acting up this time, so it's always a little bit disheartening. But
it's useful sometimes to look at pain as, well, as not your pain, but just pain, as phenomena. Mm-hmm. So it's like, this body is in pain, mm-hmm. but not my body is in pain. That kind of, I guess you'd call it objectivity regarding the phenomena, which of noticing a sensation can be noticed, can be accurately noticed as, and when it's accurately noticed, or when it's noticed without grabbing onto it, saying this is mine, or trying to push it away, neither of those, but just as phenomena, then pain can be realized as it is. And if it is, then you will notice if it is harmful to your body, and if it is time to move, and if it is an appropriate time to move. And you also will notice that this sensation can be pacified, can be actually settled into, and can dissipate. So I've had times when I've had pains in parts of my body, and they've gone in the middle of a period, and there's been no movement on my part except movement in my mind. My mind has settled. My mind has accepted it as phenomena, not as my pain, you know. Or like you said, kind of running a narrative about it or something like that. So this is really good conversation, because this is kind of like, how do we relate to something this intimate as our own sensation? And
I found it interesting that most sashin that I've attended, after the sashin is over, everyone wants to talk about their pain. you think you have pain? And it seems like pain is at the core. It's almost like death. It's sort of something we don't really want to talk about. But it really is at the core of our practice. Because I think if anything unsettles the mind, it's pain. Any kind. The slightest thing. Twinge. The mind attaches to it. But I think if you can...
It also attaches to pleasure.
Yeah.
But we don't give that the same emphasis, which is odd, because we're pleasure driven, and yet what do we talk about at the end? Oh, my knee.
Yeah, yeah. But I think too, when you say that that pain is pain, the very word pain, p- pain is a concept itself. You're talking about phenomena, sensations. But if you're sitting and suddenly you're something begins, there's a phenomenon in your knee, sensations arise. You name it, pain. That's itself a concept that begins to disturb the mind. But if what I've discovered in what they say, leaning into pain, sort of just being with it, is that these sensations come and go like everything. You know, there's this, and then there's an empty space where there isn't that sensation, and then another sensation comes in, but then we kind of wrap those all together and call it pain. But they're just sensations. But it's the pain word that begins to set the mind going.
Big discussion about the difference between pain and suffering. They're not the same thing.
This conversation is a little different from the way I believe. I mean, we're not lying on a bed of nails, you know, which is a yogic practice, which is, I understand that the Buddha rejected. And my understanding is that Full Lotus is not designed to help you overcome your pain. It's to allow you to sit for a long period of time.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It's called the comfortable... It's called a comfortable way.
Exactly. It's supposed to be... It's not supposed to be painful. So... I think that, you know, there, the word pain is being used as sort of a basket to include all physical negativity or negative physical reactions. And it seems to me that even forgetting about meditation, Buddhism, etc., just you can learn what pain is injuring you and what pain is part of your well-being or, you know, improvement. When people do all these different practices and gyms and whys and so on, you know, to
find that point where you stretch, but that good stretch that goes pushes
so
beyond.
So that you won't have so much pain in the future, you know. Yeah. So that's kind of what I think it's important to be able to distinguish between something that you're experiencing on the cushion that's just part of meditation, you know, and it will go away. You don't have to make it go away. It will go away. It just goes away. It's of its nature. And the other kind of pain, which is going to hurt you later on, and you are going to regret what you did and maybe have an operation or something. You know, that's not something I believe is part of obsession.
I agree. Mm-hmm. And so the meditation instruction, as I received it, when in the middle of a period, when you're experiencing pain, and it's actually distracting you, and it's time for you to move, to gassho, and that gassho is actually a kind of mindfulness practice in itself. So instead of just spontaneously moving, you actually bring the mind of intention to move, and you acknowledge that. So you gassho, and then you adjust your posture. So.
Good idea.
Like Cliff. and that's for you. That's a gesture for you, that mudra, but it's also for your neighbors. It's a kind of like saying, excuse me, I have to move. And then when you do move, you try and move as quietly, as carefully, and slowly as possible so not to disturb your neighbors. So that's the way I've received the teachings as far as it's fine to move during, it's okay. It's best, of course, to keep still, But if you can't keep still, if you have to move, then just gusho and then carefully, quietly change your posture. We can keep going.
Oh, keep going.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot an aid that I use a lot in sesshin, which I don't have. I'm not wearing this morning, but I'm going to put it on after lunch. I have this elastic back supporter that wraps around you, and people who, you know, like have jobs where they have to lift a lot of stuff all the time, they use them. I got it at Home Depot actually, and it's really I really appreciate it. It has some suspenders built in, and then you just wrap it around. It's elastic, and it's really. For me, it's almost indispensable.
That's not something new. I saw a stick once that comes from your mudra right to your chin. It's to keep you from falling asleep when you practice. They actually have sticks like that. It's a lot of sticks. Isn't that awesome? So just to go on as far as being teaching meditation, so when a person sits down, the important thing is that they develop a good, healthy sense of uprightness. So the way it came from Dogen is traditionally you put your hands on your knees and you move to the left and to the right, and forward and back, like a pendulum kind of finding its center. And naturally your chin will drop down, it'll come in slightly, not drop down, as your head kind of aligns itself on this column of your torso. And Coben said to close your eyes in this beginning time, and actually imagine a golden thread that's going through your spine to the back of your head, kind of pulling up to the sky. So the back of your head is open to the sky, and find that good, comfortable center of that uprightness where you're aligned with gravity. And all through your practice, of course, even though we're sitting still, there's a dynamic quality about practice. There's adjustment. So this center will be lost and then found again. We'll come back to it again and again. And everybody's body is different. Like, I have a tendency to push my belly out a little too much and become kind of sway back. So right now I'm working with a kind of plate of my my sacrum, you know, your tailbone. Getting that, instead of getting that too much forward, I want that to be right, and letting my almost letting my belly button kind of come in a little bit more rather than extend out. But other people might be more collapsed like this. They need to, you know, they need to work on other things. Your shoulders are back, and your chin comes in a little bit. Your eyes opened and cast down few feet in front of you, and your vision is a soft vision. You're not focused on any particular thing. It's just a general awareness with your vision. And from the instructions from Dogen, we take a few deep breaths. very settled into sitting, our sitting practice. The mudra. Everyone knows this mudra. Hokkai Joen, it's called, from Koban. Hokkai Joen means Dharma realm samadhi seal. Hokkai Joen. It means that everything is, all beings, everything is here with you. This is actually the center of the universe, the center, a center of the universe. It's sometimes called a universal mudra or sometimes a cosmic mudra. But Dharma Dhatu means the realm of all dharmas, of all phenomena. And samadhi means your one-pointedness or your arrival. And N, Jo, Hokkai Jo, N means seal or confirmation, like the stamp. And again, the mudra is that the Buddha hand, this is kind of a symbolism of this mudra, but this is something that Koban Shino emphasized quite a bit and talked about. I've heard him talk about this many times, that the Buddha hand, the right hand, holds the human hand. And the Buddha, this thumb, represents the human realm, and this thumb represents the Buddha realm. So they touch. So the Buddha realm and in this mudra, the Buddha realm and the human realm come together, and all the other various realms are represented by the fingers, the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, the Arhat or Shravakas, the Pratika Buddhas, the Devas. The human realm, the Asuras, the Asura realm, the realm of the competitive deities, the angry gods, the animal realm, the realm of the hungry ghosts, and the hell realms. So basically what you know, this is all symbolic, of course, but what this says, in what's very important, it says that all your psychological attributes or aspects, your hell realm part of your psyche, and your heaven realm part of your psyche, and your hungry ghost realm part of your psyche, and your animal nature, and your Buddha nature, everything is here. Everything is, when you take this mudra, you bring everything here. In other words, you don't bring your best self here only. You don't bring your Buddhist self here only. You don't bring your poor, helpless, poor me, human self here only. You bring everything comes together. That's what this mudra represents. Everything's here. So it's actually kind of scary to put your hands together like this. It's a big deal. So please be careful. You might explode.
I have an intellectual trivia question. Is it different for left-handed versus right-handed people? Might they want to do this?
I should try that.
I don't know of anyone who's ever been left-handed who's done this.
No.
I've seen other people sit like that.
The opposite?
Before I was instructed otherwise, yeah. I just, when I was sitting before I sat with Soto Zen people, or Zen people, period, I just sat like that, not knowing, and later switched to that. Mm. I'm not left-handed, though.
I don't know about that. But there's other mudras, of course. I mean, this is a mudra that we've received in our tradition. There's a mudra like this. It's the mudra of Amitabha Buddha, the Buddha of infinite light. And there's a earth touching mudra, that way. Earth touching mudra. When the Buddha was, when the Buddha had doubts about his process, his awakening, or his coming to awakening, he had all these doubts, and they were personified. They were called temptations of Mara. He basically said, "Wait a minute, I'm here, I'm on the earth, I'm grounded, like a like an electrical thing. I'm grounded, I'm here." And he touched the earth, and that dispelled his doubts that he was actually located. He was a living being, and he was located somewhere. He was of the earth, and all his doubts, Mara went away. All his doubts went away. So that's another mudra. There's various teaching mudras and things like that. And this is a practice mudra, and sitting with your hands on your knees is called a Raja mudra of the sovereignty. But this is our practice mudra.
I have a question. I have found one thing with me when I'm sitting, especially a lot like Sashin, is I'll start to have trouble with being able to breathe deeply. I think mm-hmm. just because part of it is my anatomy and probably psychological too, but I get tight up here, and when I can sit half lotus or oftentimes quarter lotus, this mudra, I tend to be able to breathe okay. But if I sit Burmese, which I have to a lot, I find it hard unless I hold it up here, and then that strains the muscles in the back, especially if I'm sitting over long periods of time. So I've finally recently started letting myself go to this a lot of times, just because it opens up the breathing. Whereas before I would just suffer through with this, thinking
you're getting tension in your shoulders from the mudra, from holding the mudra.
Yeah, if I'm sitting Burmese, and it actually becomes difficult to breathe deeply, and it feels almost like I'm suffocating on the cushion. Before I would sit through hours like that, thinking I have to maintain the mudra, because that's the mm-hmm. The practice. I have to maintain it. And
I had that same experience.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Quite frequently in my first years of practice, and then somehow it went away. And this mudra, it's almost like it has its own gravity, and it was able to hold itself up well. With these sleeves, the monks can actually make a kind of pillow for the mudra. Yeah, they're great. They also kind of cover up your knees if you're cold. They're really very wonderful. Except they're a big hassle too. Anyway, you can make a if you want to stay with this mudra. It's fine to change, but if you want to stay with this mudra, you can make a pillow or even use a support cushion and kind of build up a little place. Mm-hmm. Some people tuck them in full to their clothing to kind of hold the fold to their clothing will kind of hold it. Mm-hmm. So if you're sitting full lotus, of course, it's a thread on your heels. Of course.
Yeah.
So it's very comfortable.
Do you think that there's any advantage to holding that besides going to this if need be? I mean, I feel like sometimes I can notice that I feel a difference all over when I switch from this to this. But
in other Zen centers, they might encourage you to just always use this mudra. Mm-hmm. But as far as I'm concerned, here at Jikoji, you can switch if you want to. It is the traditional practice mudra.
It does kind of become second nature, though, after a while, because when I first started, I had really bad pains between my shoulder blades, and I would hold it, and I don't know, after a couple of years, that went away.
I actually feel a kind of energy or power here in the hara. Yeah. And so the hara, the energy of the hara and the mudra are kind of like one thing. Mm-hmm. And also when my breathing in practice becomes peaceful, settles, it usually comes down. It's not up here that I'm breathing. It's more, it's like it settles down. So my breathing, the rhythm of my breath, the energy of my hara and my mudra are kind of like all one thing.
Yeah.
And then it's really, it's good.
Yeah. You know?
And it takes care of itself.
So, yeah. Yeah. I've only been sitting a few years, so maybe it'll work itself out, but I find continually I have difficulty breathing deeply. My breath gets stuck in my chest a lot. And I don't know if that's the result of, because if I'm not paying attention, I breathe fine.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as I quiet down sitting and I start noticing, then.
That happened to me too. My awareness of my breathing disrupted the natural rhythm of my breath.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Doesn't anymore, but it used to.
Mm-hmm. Even from a medical perspective, they say chest breathing is labored breathing.
Huh.
So if you're breathing up here, it's more, it's labored, it's more an intention to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's natural when it drops, should drop down.
What else about the form of practice?
A question that also curiosity. In the story of Buddha's sitting all night, do you think that he literally sat without moving all night, or do you think he adjusted his posture from time to time? So
took a few naps?
no naps. Just
had a hemi sammy.
Is it possible just to sit, you know, for hours and hours and hours, or is it not possible to sit for hours and hours?
I've even heard that one night that the Buddha sat was a kind of metaphor for an intensive period of practice.
Mm-hmm.
That went on a very long time, many, many days.
Mm-hmm.
So that one night meant, like, he went through it, you know, he went through a whole cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no idea, I wasn't there. But I know that afterwards, the practice that was developed with him and his disciples was both walking and sitting meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So they would develop a comfortable place with reeds or grass or something, comfortable place, and bring their attention on just what was right before them, you know, not conceptual stuff, but just phenomena here as it is now, body, mind, and so on, and sit that way. And later on there was walking meditation where they mindfully walked, and then there was sitting meditation. So I presume that he did the same thing that first night, I would presume, but who can say? Well, there's more to talk about. Should we continue this afternoon after tea? Keep talking about this. And think about how it sounds strange, but how we can develop our own praxis as teachers as well as receivers, as far as conveying this information, and this afternoon let's talk about that some more. I think we need to talk about the breath and about thoughts, and we need to talk about sleepiness, what to do about sleepiness, how to balance that.